Hey friends, welcome to Girls Night. I'm Stephanie Mae Wilson, and I'm so happy that you're here. Each week, I have a girlfriend over, and we talk through one of the biggest questions we have about our lives as women. We're talking about friendships and faith and relationships and self-confidence, about our calling in life and how to live every bit of our lives to the full. Life is so much better and easier and absolutely more fun when we navigate it together as girlfriends, and I cannot wait to get started. Friends, I'm so excited about today's episode. Today, we're talking about how looking back at our history helps us understand our present, our future, and ourselves better. Our guest for today's episode is my new friend, Jasmine Holmes. Jasmine is a mom, a historian, a grad student, and a writer. She has just a few things going on. Her newest book is called Crowned with Glory: How Proclaiming the Truth of Black Dignity Has Shaped American History. Now, I wanted to have Jasmine on the show because I've spent a lot of time lately looking back at our history as women. Seeing where we've been and how we got to where things are today, it's given me so much insight and context into my present to know more about my past. So when I saw that Jasmine had written a book kind of on the same theme, I knew I wanted to hear what this has looked like for her. I wanted to hear about the journey of writing this book and about digging back into history, and I wanted to know what she's learned from it. You guys, Jasmine is a brilliant teacher. She answered all of my questions so beautifully, both the huge ones that were probably really hard to answer and also the ones that I worried might be kind of dumb. Her answers were somehow simultaneously simple and easy to understand, but also totally profound. I learned so much in this conversation, and I cannot wait to share it with you. Jasmine is a treasure. You're going to love her. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Friends, springtime is finally here, but that also means allergy season is in full swing. I have always struggled with allergies, and I don't know about you, but I am especially allergic to cats. More on that in a second. Well, luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. The time that I use Claritin the absolute most is when I'm at my parents' house, my childhood home. They have this absolutely beautiful cat that they love and I like, except for the fact that he sheds so much. So that means that I'm basically sneezing from the second I arrive home to the second I leave, unless I take Claritin. My dad has even started having it ready for me right when I walk in the door. Are you ready to live life as though you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. Claritin, thank you so much for sponsoring our girls' night. We love having you. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. As many of you know, I recently wrote a book, and while it was the most rewarding project of my career so far, it also came with a lot of hard work and long nights. And sometimes when things started to feel a little bit overwhelming, I needed to get a few things off my chest so I could clear my mind and keep the writing process flowing. And the thing that helped me so much to sort through those feelings was therapy. Now tell me if any of this sounds familiar. Maybe you're going through something really hard right now, a big loss or a gigantic life transition. Maybe you frequently feel anxious, depressed, overwhelmed, or just generally discouraged. Maybe you really, really, really want your life circumstances to change, but you don't know how to actually change them. Or maybe you're feeling stuck as you try to work through your past, navigate your present, or figure out your future. Friend, if you can relate to any of this, you're not alone. I've been there, and therapy has been the thing that has helped me more than anything else with all of this. In the last 10 years or so, I've learned that strength isn't proving I can do it on my own. It's knowing that I don't have to. I'm at my strongest when I have a full support system around me, and an essential part of my support system is therapy. Therapy can be absolutely life-changing. That is, if you can afford it and find a therapist you like and trust. But of course, this is easier said than done, and that's why I'm so excited to be partnering with this week's podcast sponsor. Our sponsor for today's episode is BetterHelp. BetterHelp is the easiest and most affordable way I've ever found to find a great therapist. It's entirely online and super easy to sign up. You can get started right away, and if you don't love the counselor you're paired with, switching is easy and it's free. If you're going through something hard in your relationships, or if you're in a funk you just can't shake, if you've been feeling anxious or depressed lately, or if you're feeling stressed and you need help balancing your everyday life and schedule, BetterHelp is an incredible resource for you. And I'm so thankful that they've given me a promo code that I can share with you to make it even easier to get started. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/friendship today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/friendship. All right, friends, I'm super excited for who you get to meet today. I'm sitting here with my new friend, Jasmine Holmes. Jasmine, thanks so much for coming to Girls Night.
Thank you for having me.
For women who haven't met you yet, can you tell us who you are, what you do, and a fun fact about yourself?
Yes. I am a historian. I have 3 children. They are 7, almost 5, and 2. I'm married to Philip. He's an entrepreneur, so we both work from home. I'm a writer, and I'm in grad school, and life is crazy. It's a little bit crazy right now, but happy crazy.
So you're like basically an underachiever who like just has a lot of free time on her hands.
I'm a slacker who is definitely not a gifted child. Definitely not.
Yes, you have a lot going on. I have 2-year-olds who are going to be 3 next month.
Oh, 2.
And so twins. But I don't have 3. So anyway.
Yeah, that's what my friends who are twin moms first are always like, I don't have anything else to compare it to. It's just, yeah, they're just, I had twins. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just how it is. It is. We'll both take naps after this.
Yes.
Okay, tell me your fun fact. I'm excited.
I have 2 fun facts, and they come from the fact that I am a homeschooler and a total nerd. So I can name all of the presidents in order from Washington all the way to Biden. And if you ask me a state, 98% of the time, I can tell you that state's capital.
That is, when I tell you that I am so jealous of that fact, I am so jealous of that fact because I was just talking to someone about this. I swear that like, I wish I could take out the lyrics of, I don't know, just off the top of my head, like the Thong Song, and replace it with all of the presidents and all of the capitals, because I feel like I would get like a D. I could do the capitals better, but the president test, absolutely not.
But I mean, like, for what though? Because we live in the age of Google. And so it's just like, if you want to know the president that came after Lyndon B. Johnson, you can just look it up in like the same 2 seconds that it takes me. You know?
I know. But okay, but my husband is like the guy who knows everything. And so he always looks at me and is like, where did you go to school? And I'm like, a good school. I just like, I don't know. That fact got replaced with like every lyric to every NSYNC song that has ever existed. And my best friend's phone number growing up. And
not a bad life. It's not a bad life. My
no, it's like
poker number fun, is still my parents' phone number from when I lived at home 10 years ago.
That is amazing.
Yep. I still get those fuel points. My parents live out of the country, so their fuel points just were bequeathed to me, and I've just kept the fuel points going all this time.
That is amazing. That is amazing. Random thing. Where do your parents live?
They live in Zambia. So right above South Africa and right next to Zimbabwe.
Cool. Okay. I have so many more questions on that, but I feel like I don't want to derail us. So we'll ask those at the end. That's really cool. So I want to tell you the backstory of why I really wanted to talk to you. I have been doing a lot of research of my own lately. Mm-hmm. looking at our history as women and just seeing like where we've been, how we got to the way that things are today, like tracing threads back of like, I feel like I'm supposed to do something this way and being like, where did that come from? And it always starts somewhere. Some person in the 40s wrote a book about whatever and women were expected to do, like it's just all tied together. And so looking back at our past as women has given me so much insight and context into our present as women. And so when I saw that you had written the book that you just wrote, I really, really wanted to hear what you've learned both in the writing of it, but then also like as you've been digging into the past, kind of the just how you've seen it all connect. It's like such a theme for me right now. So I basically am just going to like ask a, like, I know you talked about this somewhere in the book. Tell us everything that you have to tell us. Yeah. So that's kind of, that's my plan.
Okay. That's exciting.
Okay. So tell us first about the book. So the book, I have it written down. It's called Crowned with Glory, mm-hmm. How Proclaiming the Truth of Black Dignity Has Shaped American History. Tell us about the book and like, how did this project come about for you?
So the book is basically a historical survey of Black abolitionists and how they use the concept of the Imago Dei or the image of God to argue against chattel slavery, to say, hey, chattel slavery is wrong because all men are created equal. They're all created in God's image. And because of that, they are worthy of dignity and they're worthy of respect. And it was just, it's a really simple premise, but the simplicity of it is that it was everywhere in abolitionist work. It was everywhere in abolitionist speeches. It was everywhere in abolitionist petitions. It was everywhere in the conversation, the image of God, the image of God, the image of God over and over again. It was like a pillar of abolitionist thought. And I found that so interesting. And whenever I write a book, I always set out to just write what I find to be so interesting. And so I was like, I want to read a book about this. And I don't see a book about this that's like on the level that I want it to be. There's academic books about it and there's dissertations. But I was like, I want to write a book that could be used in the classroom if somebody wanted to use it, or they could read, you know, pretty easily. And so that's how Crown with Glory was born. I wrote a book right before Crown with Glory called Cards in Ebony. And it was about 10 Black women whose faith inspires us. And all of those women were kind of from the same like antebellum period. And so I just dug deeper into the research and wrote this one.
That's so cool. Okay. So yeah, I have a million questions about like really the book cover for Carved in Ebony. That's what it's called, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is stunning.
Isn't it?
It's so stunning. Pretty? Yes. It is so beautiful. I remember I have it like in my brain. Tell me, you said chattel slavery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Tell me, like, why? Talk to me through that phrasing specifically, because I know you didn't like choose it on accident.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about slavery, do you like how I just like nerdily grab my glasses as soon as I'm about to go deep into my? It's literally a habit that I do. I'm like, so
let me push these up because I'm getting ready.
I did an advisor about something and I got so excited and I was doing that, but I was like excited at the same time. And it was our first meeting ever where I was going to ask him to be my thesis advisor. And I flung my glasses across the room and I was like, please work with me. So sorry.
So amazing.
He was like, you're really passionate. I was like, yes.
I am really passionate. This is how passionate. I need new glasses. I just broke them.
The glasses are over there. Hold on. I literally had to like be like, one second. Like, go get them. Back. But whenever we talk about slavery, a lot of times people are confused about why the slavery in America is different from slavery as it was practiced in other places, in other times. And so chattel slavery is just a terminology that talks about the idea of human property. So there's all different kinds of slavery. There's slavery because your tribe beat another tribe and you take those people into forced servitude. There's the kind of slavery where somebody has a debt and so they go into forced servitude in order to pay off the debt. There's the kind of slavery that we talk about in America, which is a slavery that's based on race, a slavery that is generational. So it's passed down from generation to generation and you can't get out of it. And it's also passed down through the mother instead of the father. In England, for instance, so England had a pretty similar like baseline for slavery in the 1700s. But according to British law, if you are a white male slave owner and you have a child with a black enslaved woman, that child is free. And you have to take care of that child and you have to provide for that child because you're that child's father. Well, in America, they flipped the role and said, okay, if you are a white slaveholder and you have a child with a black enslaved woman, the child follows a condition of the mother. So that slaveholder doesn't have a child anymore. That slaveholder has more property. And so the idea is just this completely, because the slave trade, like the actual transatlantic going to Africa, bringing people overseas, was officially ended in America in the year 1808. But from 1808 to 1865, slavery in America grew three times as large. How'd that happen? Well, the whole idea of breeding practices and forcing Black women to have as many children as they could, and talking about their breeding and their slavery, the kind of the same way that you would talk about, honestly, cattle, chattel, the kind of things that are chattels. We still talk about chattel now, but when we do now, we mean land, we mean goods, we mean animals. And unfortunately, Black folk used to be lumped in with that. So that's what I mean by chattel slavery.
Are you kidding me?
No, I know. I know. It's, you know, I think one of the things that I've learned so much is that these things are not incidental. I feel like oftentimes when we talk about slavery in American history, we kind of talk about it like, oh, shucks, those founders, it just grew too big and they didn't know what to do. And so they just had to, but it, once you see like the legislative, like, no, we're making steps to keep this and we're making steps to protect this and we're exploiting those steps. Once you see that, it puts things in a whole new light. For sure.
Yeah, it's going to take me a minute. No,
I know.
I didn't know that. You said that teaching fueled you for your future, but you ended up walking away from it.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with the King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I feel like this, I'm excited to hear you tell us more about this because I feel like this is going to give us more insight into like the book and the kind of the direction it took. Yeah. So tell me, like, why did you quit teaching?
Oh, so many reasons. I quit teaching in 2021, which I feel like so many teachers, when I say that year, like, yeah, the pandemic is going on. We're ramping up on stopping the woke and the 1776 commission is out. And, you know, there's just all of these things going on. And I live in Jackson, Mississippi, and I was teaching at a very small Christian private school. And it was so hard because I loved teaching. I loved the kids that I was teaching. I was enjoying myself so much, but also was feeling the mounting pressure of there are these battle lines being drawn about history, about quote-unquote critical race theory. There are these witch hunts that are happening with teachers who are teaching certain things and using certain words. I'm teaching American history. I'm the only Black teacher in the school. And I'm teaching to a bunch of white kids, you know? And so it just built into kind of a, I'm just going to go. You know, nobody asked me to leave. Nobody told me that I needed to leave. But I felt like it was time for me to leave. And the thing about living in Jackson, I talked to my husband about this all the time because he had a similar experience with his last job here in Jackson, was it's very Southern. And so it's very like, you can stay as long as you want to stay. And then you're like, I'm going to go. And they're like, oh man, hate to see you go. And so that was definitely my experience of, oh man, well, I get it. Because, you know,
a little conflict diverse here.
We get what's happening. We get the landscape. We get that battle lines are being drawn. And so that's why I left the classroom. But I loved teaching. I miss it all the time. I miss it every day. I just told my friend the other day, we were talking, she has her PhD. She just graduated from Vanderbilt and she works at Penn State and is just like,
also lazy.
You know what I'm
also
saying?
Also lazy. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was so funny because she's from England. So she got a job at Penn State and she was like, oh yeah, I'm going to work at Penn State. And everybody was like, that's amazing. And she's like, oh, is Penn State a big deal? And we're like, yes.
It is. Yes, it is.
Yes. So I was talking to her and I was like, honestly, I think she says, well, what do you want to do with your degree? Like, what's your dream? And I said, I just want to force people to be interested in the things that I'm interested in and to make them read what I want them to read or they don't get a good grade. And she was like, you just really miss the classroom. I was like, I really do.
I do. I really do.
Really do. Yeah.
Talk to us about critical race theory. Mm-hmm. What is it and why is everyone angry?
You know, I even feel like though these days, even that phrase is being used a lot less. What I've noticed is that the terminology kind of shifts and changes. So when I was just out of college, I remember that everybody was talking about cultural Marxism. Everybody was like, cultural Marxism this and cultural Marxism that and cultural Marxism this. And then after that, it was like everybody was talking about social justice warriors, SJWs. And it was like SJW this and SJW that. And then it was like this period where it was like critical race theory. Rah! And then now I feel like we're in this period of where it's like the word is woke. And so even though all of those things are slightly different things, I think what people mean when they say them is the idea of social justice, the idea that there are inequities in this country that are based on race, that are based on sex, that are based on gender expression, that are based on all of these things, and that they are part of the laws of this country, they are part of the social networking of this country, and they're kind of baked into this country. And what do we do? How do we address those things? Now, critical race theory handles that legislatively, and I want to just really, really reiterate that it's something that's taught on not even just a college level, like a graduate law school level. So critical race theory is not a simple, it's not a simple concept. It's something that lawyers learn about in law school in order to have a principle for how they approach laws, lawmaking, and the changing of laws. But the understanding of it has kind of trickled down to mean I'm concerned that certain laws are putting forward racism, are pushing the agenda of racism. And so anytime somebody says that, it's kind of gets put into the critical race theory box, but then the box is really big and nobody really knows what's all in the box when they're talking about it. And it just gets, it gets so confusing. I don't know what the next word's going to be after woke, but I feel like it's woke now, right now.
So the concern with teaching, so no one's teaching critical race theory in schools, except for in graduate levels to like future lawyers.
Absolutely.
But when people are concerned about what's being taught, they're upset that it's being brought up that there are laws and policies that promote like keeping other, like some people down and so that other people can go up.
Yes. Yeah. And so I think if people are honest, what they're more so saying is not that they think that critical race theory, if they understood what critical race theory is, not that it's being taught in schools, but that the teachers who are teaching are coming from an understanding that is rooted in some of the things that critical race theory believes. And so then those teachers are then bringing that understanding to their students. I think if I'm being the most charitable, I think that's what people mean when they talk about critical race theory being in schools.
So why is that bad?
You know, it depends on who you ask. A lot of Christian parents have an issue with critical race theory and all of the terminology that I just used because it's not Christian terminology, right? It is of the world. It's not something that a bunch of theologians sat together and figured out. It's something that intellectuals and people in the academy have come up with and are describing. And I think that a lot of times evangelicals in this country are inherently suspicious of the academy. And sometimes that's with good reason, right? Sometimes as soon as you say you're a Christian, you just don't get taken seriously by people in certain accordance of higher ed. So again, I want to have a charitable understanding, right? It didn't just come out of nowhere. But I think a lot of people don't think that you can, they don't see the overlap between Christian ideals and some of the same things that people who espouse critical race theory believe. They don't believe that there can be overlap. They believe that it either has to be something that is from the Bible and completely divorced from anything that a secular person has ever thought or said, or it's wrong.
Okay, that kind of makes sense. But like, where my brain just went back to was Imago Dei, mm-hmm. which is like, that seems like the common ground there.
Yeah.
So is that like, I guess, is that where like this book came from?
For sure. I mean, when I started writing the book, it was very much at the beginning of a lot of these conversations about education, about book banning, about all these things. I already kind of had the book in the barrel. This is what I want to write. And then all of this stuff started happening and it was like, this is really what I want to write. because I feel like they think of all these ideas that fall under the umbrella of critical race theory as being completely divorced from biblical ideas. But there is an argument to be made, and I make it in Crown with Glory, that these ideas predate the term critical race theory. These ideas are older than Marx himself, let alone Marxism. You know, these are ideas that Christians have had from the Bible from the very beginning, and understandings that Christians have had of this country and of its deficits from the very beginning. And they've based their concerns in the Bible. And there's a way to do that is not threatened by fill in the blank with whatever boogeyman we're talking about at a particular moment.
Yeah. Okay, so talk to me about how, again, I'm asking these questions because I'm like, tell us what you have to say about this, because I want to hear all of it. Why is representation in history so important? I know that you talk about how it can shift like the whole historical narrative, and I want to hear more about that.
So I went to a very small Christian college right after. So I graduated. I was in a master's program that I didn't finish. I say I didn't finish because I'm in a master's program now, so I don't want it to sound like I have several masters. I literally am going to finish this one, hopefully. I didn't finish
this
one.
You were going to finish this one.
And so I'm sitting in my professor's office, and it's, again, a very small Christian university, because often when I tell this story, people are like, what? But you've got to understand, this was a Baptist tiny university. And so my professor was, he had the autobiography of Malcolm X on his shelf. And I was like, oh, I read that book. Do you teach that? And he's like, I used to teach it, but a lot of parents didn't want me to teach it in class because it kind of made their kids feel uncomfortable. And asking the obvious question, I was like, white kids? He was like, yeah. And I said, you know, it's really funny because nobody ever asked me if I felt comfortable when we were reading Huck Finn. Nobody asked me. Like, it's a classic. We're reading it. This is just how people thought. Here it is. And he's like, wow, I never thought about it like that. Because why would he have to at this predominantly white, super small Baptist university that's so tiny and so Christian that parents can still come to 18-year-olds teachers and be like, don't teach that. I don't like that. The idea that we don't teach things because they make people uncomfortable or they make people feel weird causes us to bypass a lot of history. The idea that children should always look in history and feel at ease causes us to bypass a lot of areas of history. But not only that, it causes children whose history is not captured in the stories of victory that make us feel good, it causes them to be overlooked. And I felt that feeling of being overlooked so often growing up in, you know, at first in private school, then I was homeschooled. So we had a little bit more freedom, but you know, you're still tied to a curriculum when you're homeschooling. And a lot of times the curriculum just didn't have people that looked like me until you got to MLK, and then you got to read I Have a Dream, and then he died, but then that's okay because everything was better after that. And then that's it. And so learning more about representation in history has been such an important experience for me as a Christian, especially because I get to see that God uses all different kinds of people in his story. he uses people from all different backgrounds, from all different ethnicities, from all different journeys. When you only learn a history that looks a certain way, it can kind of start to feel like, oh, does God only use people that look like that? Does God think more people that look like that than other people? And you can say no all you want, but if you can't give me any examples, what am I supposed to believe?
Yeah.
My friend Mari, who I just love, she's one of the wisest people in my life, and I'm just like so honored that I get to be her friend. Her daughter Ada, they were reading their kids' Bible, and Ada asked her like a couple days later, they were just like splashing around in the pool, and Ada was like, "Mommy, does God not like girls?" And she was like, "Excuse me?" And Ada was like, "Yeah, in our Bible, there's just like all the stories are about boys." And Mari was like, "That cannot be true." And she went and she looked, and like, sure enough, I think there was like one girl story. And she started to like dig deeper and dig deeper and dig deeper. And sure enough, like the amount of male to female stories that were represented in specifically kids' Bibles. And I mean, granted, like when the Bible was happening, like women didn't get to do much. And so, but that doesn't mean that they didn't. And so it was like, even in places where there are stories in the Bible of women doing amazing things or participating or being like at the front and center of things, it was like those stories were ignored in the Bibles, in the kids' Bibles. And so Mari's Bible comes out next year. So she fixed it. But I think, yeah, that's the first thing that came to mind is like, if you don't see it, then like, if you don't see yourself, then how are you supposed to know?
Yeah.
I know in the book that you talk about the importance of presenting Black kids with accurate history because of how it like affects their sense of self. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. I remember the first time that I found out that there were Black missionaries who had gone to Africa. I was an adult and I was flabbergasted, who were in Africa at the same time that David Livingstone was there, who were doing missions work at the same time as Mary Slessor, Gladys Aylward, and all the rest of them. Because growing up, I don't know if you ever read, they were little white biographies. They were like white and they had the person's name on the top and they had like a drawing of the person in the middle. And I loved those biographies. I ate them up. But the only Black person that I ever read in one of those biographies, the only Black woman, was Sojourner Truth. And so I knew about Sojourner Truth, but I was like, I guess that's it. I guess they were just busy being slaves. I don't know. And so I remember when I learned that there were missionaries who had gone overseas who had not been, like, it blew my mind when I found out that, for instance, Mariah Stewart was a missionary. She was born in Alabama. She was born in slavery. When she grew up in Alabama in slavery, neither free nor enslaved Black people in Alabama were allowed to learn how to read. Neither free nor enslaved in Alabama were allowed to learn how to read. This Black girl grows up in Alabama, ends up growing up, going to Congo, becoming a missionary in the Congo, and helping to translate the Bible into their language. Which just like blew, it just is incredible. It's incredible. It's just, and it's so unfortunate that I wasn't a child learning this and seeing something aspirational and seeing something beautiful. And again, it meant a lot to me to learn about Amy Carmichael, and it meant a lot to me to learn about Gladys Aylward. It meant so much to me to learn about Mary Slessor. I loved those. I ate those little biographies up, but there's also an added dimension of learning about someone who you relate to in even more of a way, you know, especially as a person who grew up often as the only Black girl in the room, you know, and was just taught about slavery from a standpoint that made me feel very ashamed of my ancestry instead of being proud of the resilience of my ancestors. Yeah, it's just been such a beautiful thing to like reframe that as an adult, and something that I really desire for my children as well.
Can you stop me if you're like, yeah, just stop me if you need to. Okay, how? How was history taught in a way that made you ashamed of your ancestors? Like, how was there a way to like look at your ancestors in any way other than like there's half of the equation is wrong and half of the equation was really, really wronged. Like, yeah. How are you sitting there feeling ashamed?
So I think oftentimes, and it's so funny because the book, I released two books this year. The first one was actually about shame. So I thought a lot about shame. I thought a lot about shame's impact on people. I think a lot of it can just be this misplaced feeling of if you're the only Black girl in the room and everybody's talking about slavery in the room and you just kind of feel a little awkward and everybody's like, are you okay? Are you good? Do you feel okay? And you feel like everybody's kind of looking at you. That part is just embarrassing. It doesn't feel great. And so, you know, as a child, you don't know what to do with that. So some of it's not even like the way that you're being taught. It's the way that you're not being taught and shepherded through feelings that you have and taught how to like relate to those feelings in a healthy way. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's like, yeah, you feel that. Okay, what do we do with this? And how do we remind you of this? But the other part, one of my friends just put up Stories in Color is an amazing Instagram that I follow. It's a homeschool mom who is always showing resources for being more inclusive in education. And she was just talking about a book about Harriet Tubman. And she said, you know, it's an okay book, but I'm not going to use it for my kids. And here's why. And she opens it. And in the very first paragraph of the book, it says, you know, Harriet Tubman was born during a time where a lot of Black people were in slavery. But unlike most slaves, Harriet felt like this was wrong and that she had to do something about it. And it was it's just like one clause. Unlike most slaves, this idea that most slaves were just really happy to be slaves. We're just like,
cool, yeah, this is good.
This is all I know. It's great. I don't have any greater aspiration from this. But Harriet was remarkable because she had more aspirations than your average slave. Little things like that play into this idea that Black people are other, that our wishes, that our desires, that our quest for dignity is somehow other than our white counterparts. You know, nobody would at all be surprised that a white people group who was kept in the kind of human bondage and was exploited to the degree that Black people were in the United States, nobody would be surprised if there was an uprising. Because it'd be like, yeah, you can't just keep people like that. Like you can't, like people are not meant to live like that. But our idea of people sometimes needs to be expanded to include people even when they don't look like you. And I feel like I experienced a lot of that growing up where the vision was just not expanded. And again, it wasn't maliciousness on the part of my teachers. It wasn't maliciousness on even probably the part of the textbook creators. But if you don't have Black people in the room and if you're coming from a majority context all of the time and you're thinking, I want to make sure that white kids don't feel awkward about their ancestry, but you're not concerned about the Black kids in the room, then that's the kind of educational resources that you get.
Okay. This is like such a side note, but I'm looking at something right now. I was looking to make I had like a really big wall in our house that I needed to fill. And so I ended up tearing up a book and like overlapping all these pages. And I was looking for like really beautiful, it like turned out really cool. And it took me like 20 minutes. But I was looking for, I can't show you because I'll mess it up and I won't be able to get you back. I was looking for a book with like just like really beautiful like yellowed pages and I wanted it to look old. And so I found this used bookstore and the guy showed me like all these really important old books. And I was like, no, I'm not like, I need something right. That like no one really cares about, but that like, you know, has a little bit of tint to it. And so I found a copy of Huck Finn and I was like, hey, this is an old book I was supposed to read in, you know, middle school. This is a classic. This will be like, I don't know, perfect. And so I bought that and I bought like, I don't know, Pride and Prejudice or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm pulling out the pages and I'm going, what in the world? Mm-hmm. Like, it was like, I wasn't even reading it. And I'm tearing pages being like, okay, there's the N-word. Okay, well, I'm definitely not using that. But like, I ended up throwing the whole book away. I don't know that I remembered that.
Right.
It was a lot.
Yeah, it is. And it's a lot not to be prepped for too. Yeah, I remember my husband was listening to Huck Finn on audiobook. And I was like, what are you? So I'm listening to it. I'm like, what are you listening to? And he's like, it's Huck Finn. I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, because it sounds like just this like, yeah.
I was like, what are we doing? What's going on? And it was Nick Offerman was narrating it. The Ron Swanson. So I was like, what is Nick talking about? he's narrating Huck Finn. I was like,
okay. What? Yeah, I bought it because I was like, this is a fun book about like boys horsing around on a boat. I'm like, okay, was that actually, am I thinking about the wrong book here? It's, I don't, anyway.
Yeah. And that's a thing. Like it is a fun book. It is a fun book. It has all of those parts about it that are unsavory and also those parts about it that are fun. And I think that that's the perfect example of what our history is. It's not just one thing. It's not just like this beautiful, triumphant story. It's got the parts of it that make you wince and the parts of it that make you want to turn away and the parts of it that are like, I remember the story of America as being something completely different than what this particular page in the story is telling me right now. That doesn't mean that the good stuff that you thought wasn't true necessarily, but it might mean that it's not always true or that it's not the whole truth.
Yeah. Yeah. In your research, what did you discover about the efforts of Southern educators to shift the historical narrative in the Confederacy's favor?
Oh.
I ask, as I know where a whole bunch of Confederate flags are just off the highway.
I know. It's one of those things where I'm like, I want somebody to make a movie about it. And I want these sweet little Southern ladies to be these sinister bad guys in the movie because they were, like we talked about earlier with Mississippi and leaving my job. And they're like, oh, sorry, you're leaving. Darn, we hoped that you would stay. Just kidding, bye. It's such the personality of the South. So after the Civil War, these Southern women, the daughters, the United Daughters of the Confederacy, so daughters of Confederate soldiers, all banded together. The South had an image problem because they had committed treason against the United States of America. I was just driving home from dropping my kids off the other day and I saw an American flag on the bottom and a Confederate flag on the top on a flagpole in somebody's yard. And I was like, that's ridiculous. Like one or the other, because it wasn't both. It was one or the other. And the reason why that flag can stand up there and people can drive by it and it's not like taken down for defamation or treason is because of the efforts of the Daughters of the Confederacy to like rehabilitate the South's image. And so they spent all of this time and money and energy and effort into a few things. So monuments, a lot of the monuments that we see were built in the wake of the Civil War by the United Daughters of the Confederacy to glorify Lee and Jackson and, you know, all these things. Education. So there were a lot of letter writing campaigns from Confederate women seeking to change the way that the Civil War was being taught in schools to make sure that the war wasn't about slavery. Like you think that it was, but it wasn't. It was about states' rights. It was about tariffs. Slaves were happy anyway. They were very well treated. And, you know, also, a lot of people were like, it was a missionary endeavor. We took the heathens, we brought the heathens to America, we gave the heathens Jesus. It's all good. So that was a lot of what was going on as well. And so a lot of these ideas kind of moved through Southern classrooms and were exported. You know, I do a lot of polls on my Instagram and I ask like, hey, have you ever heard, you know, this whatever element, it's called the Lost Cause. Have you ever heard this element of the Lost Cause? And a bunch of people from the South are like, yes. And some people from the North are like, I had no idea that people thought this. But some people from the North are like, yes, I have definitely heard that. I definitely had heard that the war was not about slavery. I had definitely heard that slavery was already on its way out. And I definitely heard, you know, all these other things. And it just goes to show the power of education and the power of shifting educational focus and the power of monuments kind of desensitizing us to the things that we see every day. I see the Confederate flag all the time, all the time. And even as a Black woman, even as a Black woman whose ancestors were enslaved, I don't have the same visceral, violent reaction to the Confederate flag that I probably would if I didn't see it every single day.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to me about, the war was about slavery.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure. And the war was about slavery, and they said that it was about slavery. And they had these ordinances of secession. South Carolina made the first one. And they said, we are seceding because the North is threatening our right to hold slaves. And the Mississippi Declaration said, we are seceding because the North is interfering with our right to hold slaves, which is our God-given right, and which makes sense because Black people can be out in the sun longer than we can because they're skin color. And then the Texas one said,
Wait, I'm sorry. What'd you just say?
Uh-huh. So the Mississippi was like, hey, slavery makes sense, okay? Because anyway, look at them. They're made for the sun. It's fine. It's in their ordinance. You can find this all online. But Texas is my favorite because I'm from Texas, and Texas is really good at rehabilitating its image. I'm actually writing my entire thesis about Texas versus Mississippi and how Texas is really good at rehabilitating her image and Mississippi has not been as good at it. But Texas said in their articles, in their ordinance of secession, we're seceding because you are trying to abolish slavery and you're trying to make Black people equal to white people. And that is against the laws of nature. So we are seceding. It's right there in black and white. So the fact that these ladies could take what is in black and white and what is still in black and white and make people doubt it, it's sinister. That's what I'm saying. It's like a thriller. Somebody's going to write it because it's...
But like, did you hear how I asked that? I was like, it was about slavery,
Yeah.
Right? Like it's interesting because, so I grew up in Colorado and that's like, I guess neither the North or the South. But then I've lived in Nashville for the last 10 years and I lived in Georgia for a little bit too. And so it's like, there are things that if you grew up here, you would have known or heard or learned or something that like I didn't, but there are things that I've seen and, you know, like there are no Confederate flags. Well, there honestly probably are some, in Colorado, but I didn't remember like seeing them, but I'm not kidding. There's a, if you drive down 65 in Nashville, on the right, if you're going towards Nashville, there's like a ring of them. Mm-hmm. And there used to be a statue there of, I'm forgetting his name, but it was like a Confederate statue that was like, this guy was responsible for like a massacre, like single-handedly responsible for a massacre. And like, why is this here? I'll remember his name as soon as we hang up.
It happens all the time.
Okay, so tell me about, what's the double curse of the free Black woman?
The idea of the double curse, it comes from a speech from an abolitionist named Robert Purvis. His father was a slaveholder. His mother was an enslaved woman. And so he looked white. He could have passed for white. He often was mistaken for white when he was taking transportation and things like that. But he married a Black woman, was a loud abolitionist, and was super vocal. And he also had a daughter who turned out to be a really cool suffragette. And so what he said in his speech about the double curse was, women should be allowed to vote. And I honestly think it's more important for my daughter to be allowed to vote than my son, because my daughter is both a woman and Black, which means that she is fighting against two things that this society does not prize, two things that put her at risk. And so I think she should be able to vote. Like, it's super important. We love Robert Purvis. And so the idea of the double curse just being, in modern terms, another, we would put it in other no-no terminology that people don't like, is intersectionality. But it's this idea that you have these intersecting identities, Blackness and womanhood, that kind of like overlap in ways that make your life a little bit more difficult and a little bit more complicated than somebody who does not have both of those things intersecting. And a little bit is an understatement for sure. Especially when you're thinking about Victorian times. So you have this image of Victorian womanhood that is this chaste, untouched, modest, you know, cared for. She can't see a lot of gruesome things because she'll faint. You know, she needs her smelling salts. She's just, oh, she's a lady, right? You have that, and that is living and thriving. That image is living and thriving at the same time that women, white women, are being forced to do factory labor that is very dangerous and very grueling. That Black women are living in the South being repeatedly victimized sexually, physically, spiritually assaulted on all ends, being forced to work the same jobs that the men are working, being forced to work the same hours that the men are working, being forced to give their children to other people to raise and take care of so that they can work. You know, you have those two things that are like existing in opposition to one another. And so when you have free Black women, they are neither enslaved and like living the imagery of the enslaved woman, nor are they seen as white women. And no matter what they do, they'll never be seen as white women. They will always be seen as closer to the enslaved woman than they will be seen as a white woman because they're Black. And so that kind of gets to the heart of the double curse as Robert Purvis understood it. And as a lot of women articulated it, just that tightrope of having to be a respectable woman in a time where respectable womanhood was something that was often withheld from Black women.